This next person, he was a drummer for the Hogwaller Ramblers and a director, sound designer at Live Arts. Three daughters, but now he knows the causes, what causes them, and he has seen a doctor about it. Put your hands together, Chris, first timer, Kristen Keithley.
I am speaking to you a little whacked out on both cold medicine and whiskey, so I'll have somewhat the same experience you are. I'm going to be listening to the story and hoping it turns out well. Also, one disclaimer, I do have to use the N-word in this story, and yes, I have to. But I am quoting somebody else, and I'm sure by the time we get there, you'll understand the context. All right. This is the story of my dad's funeral. But first he has to die, so this is 20 years ago, so we don't have to be all sad or anything, but it's interesting enough, so we'll go there. He was a very well-respected family practice and preventive medicine doctor in Houston, Texas, and was a great dad, loved him a lot. But he spent about a decade before the end of his life with prescription drug addictions, bad marriage problems. His mother died. He owned his own practice, and the finances were terrible. You know, lots of stresses. So one day, he just sort of bagged it, and he abandoned my mom, the practice, all the patients, and he hooked up with a business friend that I had introduced him to who was starting a longevity clinic in Cancun, Mexico, and became the medical director down there, took his receptionist with him pretty much overnight. So I get a phone call from my mom about this first, and then I hear from my dad about it about a month later, and he's doing great. He's off the drugs. He's working out every day. He loves it there and wants us to come visit, and I hang up the phone. I'm here in Charlottesville, and I'm thinking, this is really strange. And sure enough, within about 2 or 3 weeks later, I get the call that he's dead. Unfortunately, when he left my mom and his practice and his patients, he also hired a cheap lawyer in Houston to file for divorce. And he thought, well, you know, the lawyer can handle stuff while I'm in Mexico doing this thing. And he didn't show up for his, you know, divorce court hearing dates. And that he already looked kind of like a shit heel. So the judge didn't really like him to start with. And then when you don't show up for your court dates, you look worse. And so they handed down the judgment and they mailed him the papers. And it wasn't favorable. He was pretty much, you know, inherited all the debt and my mom got everything else. And so, as legend has it, he read the papers and was so upset that he went out and bought a bottle of vodka, drank nearly the entire thing, passed out, and choked on his own vomit in his sleep, which was absolutely the most rock star thing he ever did. But that's how he went. So, understandably, the family is like, what? You know, after this happening over a few short weeks. And I fly down to Houston to be with my mom for a few days before the funeral. And, of course, you know, she's going through her own level of what the fuck, because it's just, you know, it's unimaginable what she's going through. But, you know, I'm with her, and then we have to fly to Oklahoma, which is where all my extended family is, where I was born and everything else. And the day before the funeral, where I'm about to get on the plane, and my Uncle Jerry, who is my mom's brother, who is by far my favorite relative, he was a raging and impressive alcoholic. And, you know, after a lot of property damage and high-speed chases, he finally ended up in an assisted living situation that was happy for everybody, and he remains there to this day. But he calls me up. It was one of the most amazing phone calls of my life, it turned out to be, and so wise. And he says, you know, Kristen, I just want you to remember that this is your day. This is not about your dad. It may be about his memory. It may be about, you know, who he was to you and how much we all loved him or whatever, but this is for you. He's dead. He doesn't give a shit. This is for you. You do whatever you want. If you feel like screaming, if you feel like singing and dancing, if you feel like taking all your clothes off and running down the street, if you feel like telling everybody to go fuck themselves and do whatever the fuck you want, you do that. This is for you. You're his only child. He's gone. This is your day. I'm thinking, well, you know, you're fucking nuts. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's really true. And of course, But, you know, that's all fine and good, and everything's going to go fine, and it'll be sad. And but thanks, Uncle Jerry, for that, and appreciate it. And left it at that. And so we fly to Oklahoma, and it's the night before the funeral, and we're staying at my mom's sister's house. And I'm sitting there, and I'm wondering, who's with Grandpa? Because Grandma was gone, and the rest of the family was nuts. And so I asked about him. It was like, is anybody staying with Grandpa tonight? And no. My dad's dad is alone. He just lost his eldest son. He's alone in his house. And I said, this isn't right. And so I looked at my Uncle Glenn. I said, can I have your Mercedes? He's like, shit, yeah. And he gives me the keys. And I drive from Ada, Oklahoma to Shawnee, Oklahoma, which is where I was born in my dad's childhood home, and also where Brad Pitt was born. And our lives diverged dramatically after that. But So I drive there, and I surprise him. I knock on the door, and he's obviously been, you know, awake and asleep at random throughout the day. His hair's all messed up, and he's just like, his face fills up with joy. He's so happy to see me. He hadn't seen me in probably 5 years. And we exchange this huge bear hug, and he welcomes me in. And the last time I've been there with him alone, I'd flown down from Michigan when I was 11 to visit family, and I was there with my grandpa by myself. And we stayed up till 4 in the morning, and he chain-smoked and drank teacher scotch while I drank at least 7 grape sodas. And he told me all the family stories going back to when he was, you know, his great-grandfather, and I knew everything about our family history. One of the most memorable nights of my life. So I'm sitting here like, all right, I'm alone with Grandpa again, but I'm of age. This is awesome. So he brings me back to the kitchen. He's like, what can I get you to eat? You know, and he starts hauling out lunch meat and bread, whatever he's got in the fridge, And I'm like, you know, I'm not really hungry. It's okay. And so we just hang out. We don't talk about my dad at all. He doesn't ask about my dad. We don't talk about feelings about my dad. He asks about me. I talk about my life, you know, how school went, what I'm doing, job prospects, everything. He don't want to talk about it. This is a man who outlived his own wife. And he had 4 kids. His eldest daughter went crazy in her 20s, wrote a bunch of bad checks, went to jail, you know, in and out of jail, and then divorced her abusive ex-military husband to marry a guy that lived off the state because he had the mental capacity of a 13-year-old and couldn't take care of himself. And then that was the oldest daughter. And then there's my dad, and we knew what happened to him. And then the middle son, Melvin, had blown his brains out 8 years earlier after getting out of the Marines in that very house that we were in. And then the youngest son, James, a psychologist. A psychologist, but he was a psychologist working for the Catholic Church within the Oklahoma penitentiary system. And that's a level of fucked upness that, like, it rivals Inception to me in my mind. But to make it worse, he and his wife were hoarders in their spare time. So we end our evening about, you know, 1 in the morning, we go to bed. And so the next day, and I'm sorry it's going to be a little long, but it'll be worth it, I promise. The next day we get to family arrives, and we go to the church, this childhood church where my dad went when he was a kid. My grandfather probably hadn't been in, you know, 50 years. And it's just family because it was too far away for any friends to come. And so it's just family and church ladies, you know, the people making sure the flowers are all in the right place and all that stuff. And so the ceremony begins, and it begins with music. And I'm a musician, and have been accused of being a musical snob, but this violated every standard and principle I had ever even heard anyone having, even, you know, ABBA and Spice Girl fans, I don't know. Organist, flautist, violin player, and they're all playing together. They obviously had never even spoken on the phone, let alone rehearsed together. They're not in tune. They're playing standards like, you know, Bringing in the Sheaves, Amazing Grace, all the, you know, the stuff you've heard a million times. It's not in tune. There's wrong notes all over the place. And I'm sitting there, and I start to snicker myself. I'm remembering Uncle Jerry's phone call, like, oh, you know, this is my day. This is my day. And this sucks. This is not honoring my dad's memory. This is not entertaining. This is not reverent. This is bullshit. I would, you know, let's get on. And so I decide I'm stopping it. You know, we're in the middle of Amazing Grace, and it sounds like hell. I'm ready to just, you know, get out of this church anyway. So I put my hand in front of me on the pew, and I start to stand up, and I'm going to politely say, "Excuse me, we just need to stop now. We just need to stop the music, and I'd like to get on with the service part of it, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but thank you." As I'm standing up, my grandfather on the other side of the church stands up before I could say anything, and he goes, this, just like this, "Get me out of here! I am not sitting through another goddamn funeral! Take me home!" The music stops, everybody turns and looks. My uncle, the Catholic psychologist hoarder, stands up and does the exact sensible thing, puts his arms on my grandfather and says, "It's okay, Pop. I'll take you home on the chat." They leave, and I swear to God, the minister gets up and starts into this kind of thing. "We all understand his pain, his inability to face the pain of losing a child, something we cannot understand, but it's nothing compared to the pain of the fire and brimstone that we're all going to experience if we don't find Jesus." I swear to God, he went there. He went there. And so I'm reliving this all over again. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to stand up and stop this part of it. This is terrible. These people don't even know my dad. This has nothing to do with my dad anymore. And then I decided, no, I'm not going to do it, because I don't want my family to, in one afternoon, have the reputation of interrupting church services in Shawnee, Oklahoma. So I stick to my reputation of, you know, being a guy that almost does something cool all the time. So we go to the gravesite, and it's sad, and I tell a poem, and, you know, and people cry, and we come back to my grandfather's house, where the reception is supposed to be, and I walk into the kitchen, everybody else goes in the front door, I come in the back, and there's my grandfather and his older brother. My grandfather's 80, my great uncle, DV, I don't know what it stood for, is 82, and they're sitting at the kitchen table drinking scotch, and have been all afternoon, obviously. And I walk in on this line. And that's when she looked at him and said, "That's why you're a moron and will never amount to anything." And my grandfather just goes, and laughs exactly like that, with a cigarette in his hand, scotch in the other. And they've been doing this all afternoon. And the church ladies are back there trying to get the finger sandwiches and the vegetable trays together and trying to breathe, you know, because it's just full of cigarette smoke. And I look at these two and I think, you know, they spent the whole afternoon reminiscing, lifting each other up, remembering stuff, remembering good things about each other, and they're happier than anybody else walking into this house. And it just taught me such a huge lesson about being in the moment that I won't go into now. But anyway, so the rest of the evening, these guys keep drinking. Everybody else is in the front of the house, and I mingle with old med school buddies of my dad and family that showed up, and it lingers on. And about, you know, 7, 8 o'clock, Uncle DV and my grandfather disappear into the bedroom because they've had enough and need to pass out. And I spend, you know, the next couple hours with the rest of the family, and I decide I'm going to stay there again tonight. So everybody clears out, and my mom leaves with my sister and cousins, and they go back to Ada. And I'm sitting in the kitchen at about 9:30 all by myself with scotch and cigarettes and just sitting there by myself. And I don't even know what I thought about. I thought about my dad, I'm sure. You know, I just thought about my dad and everything that was going on. And then about 11 o'clock, the light comes on under the door. And I'm like, oh, good, they're awake. You know, I'm going to hang out with these two. I'm glad they're back awake. And so I knock on the door and like, yeah, come in. And so I open it up, and they're on twin beds head-to-head sitting there, and they've turned on the TV. And they're rubbing their eyes and getting themselves together. And Uncle DV puts on his glasses, which are, I swear, a half an inch thick. The kind of glasses, like, you could only see his eyes if you looked right at him. And then they were like this. Otherwise, you couldn't see him. And he was actually legally blind, I was later told, but he would still drive from town to town with some sort of advanced shape recognition. I don't know how he did it. And so Saturday Night Live is on, and you have to follow me here a little bit. This is 1992, and the movie Dave has come out. Dave was, it starred Kevin Kline impersonating the president, was the premise of this movie. I never saw it. And Kevin Kline is the guest host, so he's supposed to be giving the opening monologue for Saturday Night Live. As a play on the joke, Kevin Nealon, the Saturday Night Live regular, is doing the opening monologue as Kevin Kline, pretending to be Kevin Kline. It's very funny. They don't get it at all, but, you know, they're still laughing along with it. And so Kevin Nealon, as Kevin Kline, introduces the special musical guest, which for the evening was Willie Nelson. He introduces Willie Nelson, and out walks Chris Rock. Everyone knows who Chris Rock is? Okay. He's wearing torn jeans and a bandana and a wig and a fake beard and mustache with a guitar slung over his back, pretending to be Willie Nelson. And I'm laughing at this. It's cute. It's funny. Nice shtick. My Uncle DV, through his half-inch glasses, pays attention for a second, and he goes, in all seriousness, "Hey, look, there's Willie Nelson dressed up like a nigger." And those two start laughing it up, and they have no idea how funny that is. And I let it sink in how funny that is. And maybe on your way home, a few of you, it will sink in how funny that is. But so my father's funeral ended with one of the biggest laughs I will ever have in my life. And thanks for listening.